This week's podcast is supported by Whitney Antiques, an antique shop in the heart of Oxfordshire, specialising in historic needlework. If you would like to know more about Whitney Antiques, check out their website at www.whitneyantiques.com. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Unearth the Past, where we delve deep into the roots of interesting individuals to uncover the hidden gems of their family history. Now, the word legend gets bandied about quite a lot these days, but today on the show we have a man that has lived up to that word in every sense. Liam Harrison is an 8-time Thai boxing world champion. He boasts an unrivaled record of 118 fights with 91 wins and an astounding 51 knockouts. Especially impressive when you consider that he has fought some of the who's who of top contenders from every corner of the world for the past 20 years. But Liam's story doesn't end there. Beyond his accomplishments in the ring, he is also the visionary behind one of the most popular coaching apps on the internet, empowering inspiring athletes worldwide. And as if that wasn't enough, Liam now travels the world imparting wisdom through seminars to eager students, leaving an indelible mark on every student he encounters. He has also ventured into the realm of fight promotion with the Hitman Fight League, further solidifying his legacy in combat sports. Join us as we embark on a journey with Liam, not only to uncover the tales of his ancestors, but also to explore the intriguing intersections between his story's past and his remarkable present. Liam Harrison, welcome to the podcast. Liam, thank you so much, by the way, for coming on my podcast. I really, really appreciate it.
A bit nervous.
Oh, no, no.
See if I've got a family full of Jeffrey Dahmers or something.
You haven't. You know what, right? There's not many people that I can think of that transcend a sport. I was thinking driving here today of people that are almost bigger than the sport, right? And that is what I see with you.
Thank you. Appreciate
so,
that.
So I imagine when you started in leisure centres, probably years ago.
I was 14 when I started. My first pro fight a week before my 15th birthday, and it was in a leisure centre at George Carnell in Manchester.
So you started then at 14. Was it always Thai boxing? Because I know you're a football fan, right? He's a Leeds fan. I'm not going to tell him I'm a United fan.
I'm off.
So was it always Thai boxing? Or was there ever, you know, another sport that was going to come in?
Thai boxing was always my only combat sport. I played a lot of football, like I said. I'm a big football fan and I played as a kid quite regular. I got to quite a decent level.
What was your position?
I was centre forward. I had like scouts from Leeds and Barnsley watching me at one point as well. I played for Leeds City Boys. I played for a semi-professional club, Farsi Celtic. And even when I started fighting pro when I was 14, up until I was 17, 18, I was still playing for like the semi-professional team.
Yeah.
But when I got to 17, I ended up becoming UK number one. I went to Japan to fight and I realised that I can make something here. So I had to have a bit of a choice and one of them had to go and it was always going to be football really. And I'm glad because the experiences that I've had and the life I've got to live from it. So, yeah.
I imagine when you started, there weren't many people who were doing Thai boxing as a profession.
Mm.
Was there anybody out there like you?
No. The money was terrible when I first started and stuff as well. Like now though, like some of the UK guys now are getting massive purses. There's big money at stake and stuff. I'm fighting fucking 250 quid in like working men's clubs and that, like proper elite level fights in working men's club where everyone blowing smoke in your face and stuff like that when I were coming up through the ranks. When I got to like my mid-20s, then like my seminars took off then and stuff like that. And I didn't have to, I usually had a couple of part-time jobs just to like help me tick over with money and stuff. Because like I said, like even fighting at the highest level, the purses were shit. You couldn't survive off of it. Then into my mid-20s, all my seminars started coming on weekends and stuff. And then I've been doing a seminar a day actually as well. And then they took off and I ended up going all around Europe and then America and Canada. And I've got to travel the world teaching. And then I was the first one to start the actual online app. I sort of stole the market with that because everyone's been trying it since. And then I've just seen them all just fade away. Like I stole the market. But what I did as well, I didn't just get me on there. I went around and got loads of other fighters to come on there as well. Because I'm not that arrogant where I think I know everything. I know there's other fighters that do certain things better than me. So I got them onto the app as well. So I sort of like, I've stalled at my hacket basically with that. So it'll be anyone else coming along to do it. It's going to be tough when I've got so much on mine already. Everything everyone needs is just on there. So
you have just set up, haven't you, your own promotion?
Yeah, the Hitman Fight League, it's called.
Hitman Fight League.
Yeah, we've only been around for a year, but it's absolutely rocketed. And yeah, we're making waves as like one of the best promotions in Europe already, just after a year. So yeah, I'm happy with how things are going with that.
Going back to those early days, like you say, you were 14 when you started. I'm not going to give your age away now, right? Mm. But you've been doing it for quite a long time.
Yep.
Do you still get that same buzz? So I imagine, you know, with a football analogy, I remember Alex Ferguson saying once that once you kind of win one title, you don't sit back and relax because then, you know, you're always thinking about the next, what's next, what's coming next. If you look back on your career, have you had time to sort of enjoy it, or have you always been thinking about what's next?
Oh, I'm always thinking about what's next. Winning is a drug that nothing else can compare to on earth. Like when you get your hand raised after a real hard fight and you're the one who's got your hand raised, and that feeling is unrivaled. Nothing comes close to it. So I guess I'm always chasing that feeling. But yeah, I've had to have a bit of time off because I've been injured recently, and that's been shit. But I'm fighting again in June, so I can't stop thinking about it already. It's 11 weeks away still, and I can't wait. I just can't wait to get back in there. And yeah, I'm getting on a bit now as well, but the buzz is still the same as that first time. Every day when I walk into the gym, it's still the same buzz when I train. Every fight I have, it's still just as good as that first time I ever won. I'm not getting bored of it.
Now, I looked at how many fights you'd had. You've had 118 fights.
Yeah.
Wow. 91 victories. Mm-hmm. After you've won your first world title, where do you go from that? Like, because you are the best in the world and you've been the best in the world 8 times. I can't think of another sports person, you know, who has done that. That is unbelievable. I was just
obsessed
with it.
Yeah, I was obsessed. When I were at school, I had my first pro fight when I was just a week before my 15th birthday. So I went to obviously at school at the time and stuff, and I was just sat in lessons. I was paying no attention whatsoever to what were happening. I was just daydreaming about fighting. I just could not stop thinking about it. That's all I were ever doing. I was looking at the teacher and I'm looking at him and I'm not paying attention. I'm in my head, I'm like slipping and punching. Sat there and he's going, "What are you doing, Liam?" I went, "Oh, sorry, I don't know." But that's how obsessed I were. I was just sat there and I was thinking, "I'm going to do this in my next fight." And he's like, "Are you paying attention?" I'm like, "Nope, not one bit, sorry." But yeah, that's how it was. Like when I won my first world title, I think I were 18 or 19 in Italy against a real tough Italian fighter. And I beat him and I stopped him in round 4.
Yeah.
And they all started throwing bottles at me when I were in the ring, all Italians. Because what he did was I stopped him with leg kicks and he turned his back. And the referee should have waved it off, but he didn't. So I just ran over and booted him up his ass. And all the Italians started throwing bottles at me when I were in the ring. But yeah, that was my first win. And then to go over into someone's backyard and do it as well, that was just such a buzz when he came out to the ring and everyone were cheering for him and then everyone like booing me and stuff. I loved it. And again, like that rush that I got from that, I was like, oh, won a world title, we're not stopping here. Let's see what else we can do.
Now, I know you're still going. I know you've got a fight coming up this year and you're going to keep fighting. Looking back on your career, what do you want your legacy to be? I've already mentioned that I think you're a trailblazer and I think you've paved the way for other fighters now coming up, especially in terms of money, in terms of, I think, the treatment of fighters. But what do you want your legacy to be?
I just want to be remembered as that guy who like always used to like bring entertainment and value for money when I used to fight. I'm always be involved in the fight of the night and always exciting. And yeah, I want to be able to inspire. I want people to look and see, oh, that's just a kid from a council estate in Leeds who's really made something of himself and stuff like that. So yeah, just that really.
Was there anyone else in your family, by the way, that was like, how did you...
My cousin Andy's 5 times world champion. So he was the one who actually brought me to the gym when I was 14. He said, oh, no, 13 I was when I started. And he said, oh, I'd never even heard of Thai boxing. I didn't even know what it was because all I were interested in at the time was football.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, I've just started this new sport. Do you want to come down? I said, it's Thai boxing. I said, what, like kickboxing? Went, no, it's different. And I'm from a bit of a rough area. So I thought, I'm doing what I'm like. Because you can't fight where I'm from. You'd get eaten alive.
Yeah.
So I walked in a gym. And the first time I walked in, and that gym where I train now, I've trained there for all my career. That started in 1992. I went there in 1998, and when I went, they had loads of British champions and European champions. And I remember I walked through the gym doors for the first time, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, I'm like, what's this? And I seen them all kicking the pads and being rash, 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 and all this noise and the smell of the boxing oil and all that. And that the gym we're in is a bit of a shithole, but it's like a Rocky gym. It's like no rundown and like just that just hard work goes on there. And I remember walking in the first time thinking, wow, what is this? And yeah, not really, I was just hooked.
That was it. Right, well, should we delve into your family tree?
Let's go.
So we're going to start your tree then, Link, with your great-grandfather, Albert Harrison. He was born in 1908. And just before the war, in 1939, we have something called the 1939 Register. And I found him on the register. He's living at 16 Neville Walk, and he's employed as a labourer. I can say that you are definitely, on your dad's side, Leeds.
Yeah.
What does Leeds mean to you? Have you got...
I'm a big football fan as well. Yeah, I know, love the football team. My dad's a big football fan, so are my granddad. I love Leeds. I love that. And before, like I say, we're from a bit of a rough area, and that LS9 is renowned for being a bit like rough and ready and that where we're from. But yeah, I love it around there.
Well, that's good because, as I say, the Harrisons, Leeds through and through. So I found Albert on the 1939 register. Also at the address is his wife, Ada Booth, and his mum, Teresa. Then the next record that I found him on was something called the 1921 census. And he's living with his mum, Ada, his dad, James, and his two brothers. And they're living at 10 Greenfield Terrace. Now, I know that the family must have moved to that address sometime before 1918, because I managed to find Albert's dad, which would be your great-granddad, I managed to find his World War One record.
Oh, wow.
Which I was going to show you. So he was in the RAF. Did you know any of your ancestors, Liam, had been in the war?
No. I met my great-granddad one time, I think.
Did you?
I think when I was really young.
Right, okay.
That's pretty cool, that, isn't it?
James Harrison, Liam's great-great-granddad, was born in Leeds in 1871. His World War I service record reveals that he joined the RAF on the 11th of July, 1918, as an aircraft hand. He is described as being 45 years old, 5'4¾", with a ruddy complexion and light brown hair. His character is described as very good. His service record reveals that he served in France between the 2nd of August, 1918, and the 30th of January, 1919. During this time, the RAF were taking part in the Battle of Amiens, which began on the 8th of August to the 11th of August. This was when over 1,900 aircraft joined over 500 tanks from the Tank Corps and more than 2,000 guns from the Royal Artillery to launch a joint offensive against the Germans at the River Somme, just to the east of Amiens. This joint attack was the first of the 100 Days Offensive, which was a series of joint Allied attacks, which would eventually lead to the end of World War One on the 11th of November, 1918. Now, he is not the only one of your family to be involved in the war effort. In fact, all your great-granddads are involved in some fashion in World War One, as you probably would expect.
Yes.
Sticking with James Harrison, Liam's great-great-granddad, the next record I have for him prior to the war is the 1911 census. On this census, he is living with his wife, Teresa Wood, and his seven children in a two-up, two-down terrace on Beckett Street. He is also working as a general labourer at the local soap work, a job which he held for the next decade. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't able to confidently go back past James with the paper records, and that's because I am not 100% sure who his father is. On his marriage to Teresa Wood, the father is listed as James Harrison, a greengrocer. His birth certificate doesn't list a father's name, but his mum is listed as Anne Harrison, and the address they are living at is East Street. Once I got the address, I decided to search East Street on the census. And in 1871, I find a young James, his mum Anne, and his siblings all living on East Street. However, they do not have the surname Harrison, they have the name Oddy. And the head of the household is a James Oddy, Anne's husband, and he is a greengrocer. All the children also have the surname Oddy. So, could James Oddy, the greengrocer, be James Harrison's dad? Well, we'll never know, not unless the closest person living to James Harrison takes a DNA test. Going back to Albert Harrison, which is your granddad, he marries a lady called Barbara Woodhead. Do those names familiar for you? Now, Barbara's parents were called Tom and her mum was called Edith. Do you remember Edith?
Yeah, I remember Edith.
We're going to stick with Edith line, if that's all right, for the time being.
Edith Keady, Liam's great-grandmother, was born in 1920 in Leeds. She's the daughter of Nellie and James Keady. James, Liam's great-great-granddad, was born in 1889 in Leeds, and he spent his young years working as a glassblower. Glassblowing has been on the Keady side of Liam's tree for generations. The first physical record I have that mentions the profession is Liam's five times great-granddad James Keady's apprenticeship indenture contract. James was born in Newcastle in 1795, and his indenture record from when he was 14 states that his apprenticeship would last 7 years. In that time, he would be paid 3 shillings 6 a week for the first year, rising to 8 shillings per week in year 7. It was his son, also called James, that moved the Keadys from Durham via Rotherham and then to Leeds. The last of the Keadys to be involved in the glass industry was Liam's great-great-granddad James. He worked for Lax and Shaw, a Leeds glass company founded by Thomas Lax and John Shaw in 1891. By the time we get to the start of the 20th century, the profession that had been in the Keady family for well over 100 years was becoming increasingly more unstable. Competition from abroad and advances in technology, which led to the mechanisation of glassblowing, meant that glassblowers like James were increasingly out of work in the lead-up to World War I. In 1914, at the start of World War I, James and his three brothers, Arthur, Thomas and John, all sign up. James signs up in Leeds on the 19th of December 1914 and joins the Royal Field Artillery as a gunner. At the time of his enlistment, he's 25 years old and working as a glassblower. James's older brother Arthur signs up at the end of November 1915 and he joins the Yorkshires before being transferred to the Royal Engineers. The youngest two brothers, Thomas and John, also join the war effort. Thomas signs up in 1914 and he joins the 6th Battalion of the Yorkshire Regiment, known as the Green Howards. John, the youngest of the four, signs up to the West Yorkshire Regiment and he quickly rises up the ranks and by 1916 is a sergeant. James, Liam's great-great-granddad, Arthur and John all saw active service in France during the war. However, Thomas's military career took a different path. Thomas remained in Britain for training for most of 1914 and for the first half of 1915. On the 3rd of July 1915, the battalion leaves Liverpool and embarks on a 7-day journey to Mudros, which was an Allied camp in Greece. The battalion were about to play their part in one of the worst fronts of World War I, Gallipoli. Attacking Gallipoli was seen as a strategic battle that would relieve pressure off Britain's ally, Russia. It would also mean that Allied ships would be able to pass through the Dardanelles and take Turkey out of the war. On the 6th of August, Thomas and his comrades were on a landing craft heading to Silver Bay. This would be his first experience of combat. The boat reaches the shore sometime after 10 o'clock in the evening. As they disembark, the Turkish troops are raining bullets at them. The order was given not to fire. Instead, they were to charge with their bayonets. Private Mick Mordew stated, "It was like facing certain death, but our regiment, who were the first to land, never faltered." Thomas and his regiment continued fighting. At 3 o'clock on the 21st of August, the battalion attacked enemy trenches just south of Hill 50. Several men were killed and injured. The following day, at 10 o'clock in the evening, the Yorkshires made their way back to the beach. Missing from the group was Thomas. He was officially declared missing on the 22nd of August 1915. 8 months later, this was changed to killed in action. He was 24 years old. His body was never recovered, but he does have a memorial plaque in Gallipoli. The battle in Gallipoli was seen as a military disaster, with huge losses on both sides.
The fighting would last for 10 months, 3 weeks and 2 days before the troops were eventually evacuated. While news was filtering back home that Thomas had been officially killed in action, James, Liam's great-great-grandfather, and his two brothers, Arthur and John, were fighting in France. Arthur and James were on the front line with their respective regiments. The youngest of the four brothers, John, had arrived in France in the February of 1916. John was part of the 17th Battalion of the West Yorkshire Regiment. While fighting with the battalion on the 13th of April, he was shot twice by a sniper and was fatally wounded. Both James and Arthur survived the war, although Arthur does receive treatment in hospital in 1916 because he is exposed to a gas attack.
So out of the four lads, two are killed, one's injured.
The poor mum, I guess. Bless her.
I have got a newspaper article if you want to see it.
Oh, yeah, please.
I'll just let you have a look at that.
Men have fallen. That's pretty cool, isn't it? Well, not the fact that he got shot in his head.
I know
pretty
what you
cool,
mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I said that before. I just read that part. He was shot in the head.
Twice.
By a sniper, yeah.
Yeah. Your great-great-granddad, James Keady. Do you want to see a picture of him?
Yeah. I'm trying to, like, picture in my head who I think he looks like in family, but I can't really.
No.
Can't really tell. How old will he have been there, then?
He looks quite dapper, doesn't he, though?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
It's like
something off of Peaky Blinders or something. Yeah. Bang this flat cap on his head.
Before we move on from the Woodhead Keady side of the tree, I just want to talk a little bit about Liam's great-great-granddad, Tom Woodhead, who was married to Elsie Rawnsley. Tom was born in 1893 in Leeds, and he was a coal miner, as was his dad. In the August of 1914, he marries Elsie, and then he joins the war effort as a driver in the Royal Field Artillery. Although he survives the war, while on active service at the end of the war, he catches pneumonia, which sadly proved fatal. He died on the 21st of February 1919 in Leeds, and he is buried in Hare Hills Cemetery.
So he was involved in the war effort. While he was serving, he caught pneumonia, and then he sadly passed away.
Shame it.
Yeah.
Got through the war, and then...
That's it, got through the war.
Got taken down by pneumonia.
Pneumonia.
You'd be gutted, wouldn't you?
You'd be
get all the way through, have a medic, and then boom, dead. You would be fuming, though, wouldn't you, if you got through all the war and all the fighting, and then pneumonia took you.
Now going to go a step back to his dad, to your great-great-great-grandfather, and he was called John William Woodhead. I have got a picture of your three times great-grandmother, yep, Sarah Jane Ross. She is married to John William Woodhead, who we've just spoke about. Would you like to see a picture of her?
Yeah, please. Bloody hell. Oh, they didn't have the looks on that side of family, did they? Jesus Christ. Oh, that's a belter.
So I'm going to ask tentatively, does she look like anyone in the family?
I don't know.
No.
No.
Sorry to interrupt the podcast, but this will only take 60 seconds. Now, as many of you know, I'm a proud supporter of The Power of One, which is an amazing organisation that supports women across the globe who have dedicated their lives to animal rescue. One organisation that we are supporting is Animal Friends of Turkey. This UK registered charity, founded by the brilliant Carol Holbrook, has a simple aim, and that's to find a way of offering loving and caring family homes in the UK for the abused and abandoned street animals in Turkey. Currently, the charity is desperately trying to expand one of their sanctuaries, run by Brenda Gibson, so they can provide a safe play area, home experience, and more secure enclosures for the dogs in their care. In order to do this, they need to raise £9,000, and they are totally reliant on public donation. Now, I know times are tough. I know times are hard. If you could donate anything, a pound, £5, that would be great. But if you can't, and I know I say this all the time, please just spread the word about this remarkable organisation. All the details about the organisation, The Power of One, and the charity Animal Friends of Turkey can be found in the podcast description. Thank you so much for listening. Now back to Liam's family tree.
I'm just going to delve then into your mum's side of the tree.
Sad work because they're all over the place.
Your mum's dad is all Scotland.
Yeah.
Right? Dundee.
Yeah, Dundee.
All Scotland. Your mum's mum is Somerset.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you know that?
Yeah, and she lived near Wookie Hall.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So the whole family is from Wookie.
Mm.
I didn't even know this was a place, right? Are you from Somerset? Do you know Wookie? It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Have you been?
Yeah, but when my grandma, her sister had a big farm down there.
Right.
So yeah, we went down and stayed for a week or so. On farm, it was beautiful.
So your grandmother was Molly Cox.
Yeah.
Yeah. Her dad, your great granddad, was a gentleman called Harold James Cox, and he was born in 1907 in Wookie Hole, as we just mentioned, in Somerset. He was a papermaker. I think that's literally all they did in that village. He was a papermaker. His wife was called Agnes Maud Stock, and Henry was one of 12 children born to
12.
to your great-great-grandparents, Adolphus Frederick Cox and Harriet Chambers.
Pretty cool names, aren't they? Adolphus.
Adolphus. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. How do you spell that?
Adolphus. If you, I'm not sure if you have kids, but if you're going to have kids, I feel you should carry this on.
Adolphus.
Adolphus.
I don't think I'd get away with that one.
No, if I'm honest, yeah, you'll probably end up single. But I managed to find Adolphus Cox. I managed to find his obituary in the newspaper. He died in 1939. I know a bit about him. So he was a papermaker. He loved cricket. He was pretty good at playing cricket. He was a real pillar of the community. He was part of the Methodist Church. And he had a keen interest, quote, in all village affairs. Has that surprised you?
Yeah, to be fair, I don't know much about my grandma's side of that family and stuff like that.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Adolphus's parents were called Henry Cox and Anne Allen. The Allens were the only members of Liam's Wookiee ancestors not to be involved in papermaking. Anne's father was called Samuel and her mum was called Charlotte. And these would be Liam's four times great grandparents. The Allens owned a beer house called the New Inn. The Beer House Act of 1830 enabled any ratepayer to brew and sell beer if they acquired a licence for 2 guineas. Beer houses had their hours restricted on a Sunday, and I think it's fair to say that Samuel didn't always stick to the rules. He was caught twice by PC Little, once at 4 o'clock on a Sunday with drinkers on the premises, where he was fined £1 and costs, and on another Sunday he was caught again by PC Little, this time with 3 neighbours drinking in the pub at 11:35 in the morning, and he was fined £2 and costs. The Allen family left the New Inn sometime in the late 1870s. In 1880, some servants of a local man named Frederick Downing were travelling home when they found Samuel's body slumped on the bank of a brook. Samuel was alive and made some groaning noises, and as he tried to get up, he fell into the brook, hitting his head in the process. He was pronounced dead at the scene and his body was taken back to the New Inn where his inquest was held. Your great-granddad, Harold James Cox, he was married to a lady called Agnes Maud Stock and she was born in 1908. Her dad was called Henry William Stock and her mum was called Agnes May Foot. Right? And I'm going to come back to her in a minute. Now, I managed to research the Stock side of your family tree back 7 generations.
Oh, wow.
To the 1680s, to the time of Isaac Newton, and to the founding of Pennsylvania. So your 7 times great-grandfather is a gentleman called Israel Stock.
They've got pretty cool names, aren't they? Like
I know.
These names.
You know what? It beats like John, doesn't it?
Yeah,
like 50 million, like John.
I like the name Israel. That's a good name. Like.
Yeah, Israel, Adolphus. If we just come back down a bit more into the present and we go to your 4 times great-grandfather, he was also called Israel Stock, which was why I was able to find him because everybody's called Israel.
Right.
He was born in 1808. And shock horror, he was a papermaker. I did find, though, with him, I found him on a few census records saying that he was a papermaker. And he was, as I mentioned, he was born in 1808, but he died in 1852. And I thought to myself, that's quite young, isn't it, to die? So I did manage to find what happened to him. And I discovered that he was actually admitted to the Somerset County Lunatic Asylum. Now, I don't want to say, does it run in the family?
No, but... I've been waiting for this part, yeah. But I thought, it's got to come out somewhere. Yeah. Got to come from somewhere. Everyone's insane at this end of the family now.
It doesn't say
why, no?
No, it doesn't say why. But...
I would be interested in that.
But I do know that he dies there.
Right.
So he dies there. I'm pretty sure, I've done a bit of research, I'm pretty sure this is a proper sort of lunatic asylum. Some asylums also doubled up as hospitals.
Yeah, but it's a proper where but, all the crazies go.
Well, you said, didn't you, you wanted a bit of crazy in your family. Yeah.
I'd say it's got to come from somewhere, so.
Yeah, but, you know, as I say, I think it might have come from him.
Yeah.
But I don't know why he's admitted, but I do know that he does die in there the year later. Now, I mentioned Agnes May Foote a short while ago, and she was born in 1870. Her parents were Thomas Reed Foote and Sarah Ann Brindley. I've got a picture of Thomas Reed Foote, if you'd like to see it.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic image of him. So this is Thomas Reed Foote with his son and his wife, Sarah Ann Brindley, who I'm going to come on to in a minute.
Looks like a mystical wizard. He does.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah. He looks like something out of Harry Potter.
So, who are them two? Who's that then?
So, okay, that's his son.
Yeah.
Who's in the war. And that is his wife, Sarah Ann Brindley.
Yeah.
She's quite an important character within the village. And I found a whole article dedicated to her life.
Mm.
So, it turns out that she lived to 91.
Good innings,
yeah.
Back then as well.
Always worth making a note of when people life expectancy. Mm. And she was a midwife in the Victorian period, which again is somewhat unusual, you know, to have an ancestor that's a midwife. And there's just a tiny picture of her, which you can't really see, outside a house, getting some nice flowers.
She looks like my grandma. Proper.
Wow.
Yeah, really. Wow, she's like twins. Yeah, it proper looks like her. If you can tell me and you give me that, I'd look at that and go, that's my grandma.
Did you think, I know obviously nobody knows what to expect in the family tree, but I searched everybody and it just seems, Liam, right, your family tree is full of really decent, hardworking people.
Mm. I wasn't sure what to expect. I sort of expected that from my grandma's side, like.
Yeah.
I didn't expect them to all be papermakers, like, but it can't be a very exciting life for any of them. But yeah, I thought there might be some crazies running around somewhere. Or
did you?
Yeah.
But just a decent family, who I think just worked out.
I'm just buzzing now. There were no like Ted Bundy running around or anything like that.
No.
So I'm quite happy.
I was gutted. I was like, oh, this is a murderer. Yeah. I always ask my guests one question, right, before you go. And that's this. If you could have dinner tonight with anybody who's no longer with us, right, it can be in your family tree or whatever tonight, who would it be and why? And what would you cook them?
That lady you pulled up, if she looked funnier, I'd like to sit down and chat with her. Yeah, but she were a character.
Your great-great-great-grandmother.
Yeah,
I like that.
We don't think it really matter what I'd cook her, because it looked like she'd eat it anyway, didn't it?
Yeah, but, she looked like a nice lady, didn't she?
To be fair as well, like some of them, the geezers, like the brothers who were in the war.
Yeah.
That one of them would be a good one to sit down with. And
Liam, it's been a bloody pleasure, honestly.
Thank you, it was interesting.
You are great. Come back anytime.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, mate.
Nice.
Oh, thank you. So that is it for this week's podcast. I'd like to say a huge thank you to my brilliant guest, Liam Harrison. I would also like to thank Whitney Antiques for supporting this podcast, and also Sam from The Power of One. I couldn't make this podcast without you guys, so thank you very much. Details about Whitney Antiques and The Power of One can be found in the podcast description. Research assistants on this episode, as always, are the fabulous Javeri Salim and Lucy Stott. And a huge thank you to you, to every single one of you that listens to this podcast, that downloads it, likes it, subscribes it, whatever you do nowadays. Thank you so much. We were in the top 5 again this week on the Apple Hobbies podcast chart. So thank you for that. If you want to contact me about any aspect of the podcast, you can do so via my website, which is www.michaelahume.com.
If you want to contact me regarding research, you can do so via my research company, which is www.rosthernresearch.com. Have a great week researching, folks. See you next week.